On this week's show, special guest Paul Pui of the Airbits Bitcoin Wallet, the new decentralized.fm, Morgan Spurlock's Bitcoin documentary, the net neutrality debate, and potentially dangerous implications of the blockchain.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest episode here of Decentralized. We have the usual Decentralized crew, can't speak today, including Dr. Jeff Peterson, who's a special guest sitting in with us today, and we're talking about a bunch of new issues. How's everyone doing today, and what's new on today's docket?
Well, so first things first, we have launched a new website. You can find us at decentralized.fm. We're really taking this whole decentralized thing to heart. And as such, we've sort of baked in a couple of features that we feel are really important. Obviously, you can directly listen to the audio on our website, but the more notable features are we offer a direct MP3 download, and because of that, we also offer the ability to check the integrity of that download so that you can verify that no one has manipulated the content between us and you, wherever you got that file, and I'll talk about a couple of other ways to acquire that acquire the podcast here in a minute, you can check to make sure that you have the exact copy that we published when we published it, all right? So, some of the alternative methods that we've added to distribution are torrents, and we have a couple of other plans down the line, but for today, you can also download torrents of every single one of our podcasts that we've ever released at decentralized.fm. We offer, in case you know your network happens to block torrent files, we also offer a magnet info hash, so it will directly launch your torrent client if you have one. And also, our Bitcoin donation address is now baked directly into the site. So those of you who are active users of Bitcoin, you just simply click the donate button, and your Bitcoin wallet should launch. So we're really excited about this. It's been in the works for quite some time. And we hope that this is a real good starting place for some of the larger, more decentralized plans that we have in the future. So again, that's decentralized.fm, and we're super excited about it.
I do like a good teaser, Eric, and you've definitely done great work with creating this website. We're really excited about it. I think Tony wanted to talk about some really interesting news this week and over the past few weeks in regards to kind of Bitcoin adoption and interest in Bitcoin from the outside world. We're interviewing Paul Pui of Airbits later on in the show, but we're definitely seeing a lot of interest from outside the community as well. One of these was Morgan Spurlock, the documentary filmmaker who produced the smash hit Super Size Me back in the day. He actually, on his Inside Man CNN show, recently did a special on Bitcoin. Did any of y'all have a chance to watch this?
I did, and I loved it. Loved it, loved it, loved it. I liked it actually more than the Rise and Rise of Bitcoin documentary, which I thought was pretty solid. But if as far as like my relatives that go, Bitcoin, you know, didn't the CEO kill himself? As far as those kind of people, I will forward them this link and have them watch this video and feel fairly confident it explains everything they need to know in a really easy to understand way. And, you know, it really was a great job. I was not expecting it to be nearly as good as it was. You know, other than Super Size Me, I'm not a huge fan of Morgan Spurlock, and by that I mean I haven't seen as much of his work, but he did a great job on Bitcoin, and he seemed very, very positive on it at the end. So this is the kind of thing that Bitcoin really needs in order to grow, and it needs a lot more of these with more and more credibility. I'm interested to see how the Nielsens turn out for this. Is this something that the general public is into at all, or is it something that really has that niche of a niche where the fans of his show that are also fans of Bitcoin watched and everyone else kind of just tuned out? I don't know what the reach is right now, but as far as a great introduction to Bitcoin to people that have no idea about it, I can't think of anything better that has been on the air.
Yeah, I totally agree. I had a chance to watch it here at my day job, and we watched it as a team over lunch, and it's pretty good. I was, you know, fascinated by the fact that, you know, Morgan actually really became a fan of it throughout the process. That was really cool to see. About the Nielsen ratings and all of that, I don't put much stake in all of that, especially in the accuracy of it is questionable. But if it's accurate at all, I would definitely rank it. I would probably put it up there as being a higher viewership. I think the CNN spot, the fact that it was, you know, Morgan Spurlock, a lot of people who just weren't familiar with Bitcoin were going to start tuning into this. It was at a really good time during the night, so I think a lot of people had the opportunity to catch this and see what it was all about.
As far as the Nielsen ratings, I love that you brought that up. I would question everything to do with their accuracy, because a lot of the Nielsen ratings are still done by viewers taking journals, and that's not exactly an accurate way to gauge anything in 2015. So you're right on that. I'm still interested to see the numbers, because they're the closest thing we have to anything accurate. But, yeah, amen. Good job to him. Great job. James, what are you thinking about this?
What's so interesting about this was that it's not just another sort of niche mention of Bitcoin in the media. I mean, every now and then you get on a CNBC show or some kind of trading show, a slight mention of Bitcoin, usually in derision, sometimes increasingly with some level of significance from the host. But with this, it's an entire special devoted to Bitcoin. And when I first saw the commercials for this, actually seeing Andreas Antonopoulos on CNN. I was dazed for a moment. It's just very, very strange. And actually seeing the show itself, seeing the curiosity and the openness with which he threw himself into this new world, this new technology, it's exactly what we need. It's exactly what, you know, I think most first-time Bitcoiners have. I don't know whether Morgan Spurlock is a Bitcoiner, but he definitely showed a lot of the curiosity you really need to understand this. So, whether he was buying coffee for his crew with Bitcoin or going to a Bitcoin mining facility and just sort of experiencing all that, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, I learned a few things sort of about how all these parts of Bitcoin work, what sort of merchants are seeing as their problems in adoption, and sort of what it takes for an average Joe to kind of get their head around Bitcoin. And I think he did a really good job of that.
What do you think the impact? So he recorded it, I think it was last summer, so almost a year ago, and the price was up at like $600. What do you think the impact is going to be to sort of like the viewers who are coming and watching it now, and then they go look at Bitcoin and it's like it's down at like $290? Like, what do you think that's going to be?
I think it's like anything else. They're going to view it as an investment first, because that's what everyone thinks Bitcoin is. And they're going to say it's a terrible investment, everyone was right, it's a scam, and they're going to see the $200 and they're going to forget all about it. Those who are more interested in the technology will look at it and say, oh, the transactions are rising, this is far from dead, in fact, it's growing, you know, greatly, and it will continue to go. I don't necessarily think the price really does matter in the end to those who are viewing it as a technology. As an investment, that's all that matters, and it's hard to change that mindset.
How do you think we get this kind of coverage from the media in general? Because I know this is very unique, obviously, in terms of the reception we've gotten for Bitcoin and sort of the depth of interest and attention paid to it. So obviously taking the time to actually interview an expert in the space like Andreas rather than just sort of some guy off the street, as many news outlets seem to do. How do we get this kind of repeat coverage for Bitcoin? What do we need to do in order to target media figures like this and really get their attention?
I think we just keep doing what we're doing. Some of the major businesses in the space that are sort of cropping up now, you have, you know, Bits. I think it's Bits, which is the over OTC traded Bitcoin funds. You start having some of these like things that take multiple years to orchestrate are starting to hit the markets now. I think that, you know, this is going to continue to grow in terms of media attention. I don't think that there needs to be any additional effort. Just keep your head down, focused on whatever business you're building, whatever, you know, product you're building, and just keep doing it. Keep doing it. Of course, pop your head up from time to time, right? Like, if you're building something cool, like, sometimes you need a break. Pop your head up, take a double check of the market, and put your head back down as long as you're still building what you think the market will need. I think that's what's really important. It's really easy to get distracted by, you know, all the press, you know. I like the fact that he interviewed Dan Kaminsky, right, who is a Bitcoin fan but is also a notorious InfoSec researcher, which is really exciting. So it shows that the scope is expanding. But it's so easy to get distracted by, you know, all the things that are going on and just get caught up in the, you know, the hullabaloo about it. Oh, it's getting even better. It's happening. People just need to sit down and focus on building product.
Amen to that. And with that being said, let's follow up a little bit about what we talked about last week, which is net neutrality. It was a heated debate, and unfortunately, we had even a second heated debate that existed off air, which was just as good. But you know, those will be lost to the archives of wherever. But let's speak about this now. What do you guys think about what happened, the final result, and you know what's to come as far as this entire net neutrality debate?
So there was two sort of big things that happened, right? One was the official FCC decision to regulate it as a common carrier. I wrote up a piece sort of in response to this, and I published it to Medium, and you know, I feel that the common carrier regulation is actually harmful, and I for reasons that I detailed in that post. We'll share a link in the show notes. But also, the second thing that happened was that they also ruled to break up the existing monopolies, right? Which is really interesting, and I'm curious what the impact of that will be. And I think that's the thing that everybody's missing. James, what do you think?
Right. So this decision, obviously, I think what you're saying is they basically moved toward the reclassifications of Title II utility, but they sort of put some limitations on what that actually means in terms of the regulations themselves. Sort of towards the end, sections on forbearance of their open internet regulations. So I don't think that perhaps this is as sweeping a change as perhaps some people were phrasing it. I think one of the articles you showed me, Eric, was kind of a statement that it's not entirely a move toward regulating the internet as a utility. It's definitely moving that closer. I'm not happy about it. But again, I think with any of these things, it's hard to say exactly what's going to turn out from that. I'm certainly not sympathetic at all to the cable companies and the ISPs. I'm certainly not sympathetic to the FCC either. So I think we need to continue to build the alternatives for a more decentralized internet in the process, and actually see how these things pan out, because it's really hard to decipher a lot of these rulings and a lot of these happenings, and what exactly it'll mean for us as users. It may be 5-10 years down the line before we see any results from this, but I guess in general, in sort of summary for me, I think somewhat of the sort of uncritical attitude that was taken toward net neutrality, sort of by sort of the larger tech community, maybe a little bit concerning, I guess, at least in terms of skepticism towards government, skepticism towards centralized authority. I don't think this is a long-term solution.
One of the things that strikes me is, like, maybe it's just me, maybe it's my impetuous nature, but I'm just not at all satisfied with how far it went. Like, not only am I dissatisfied with, you know, the fact that, you know, we're all trusting, you know, some government, you know, to protect us, right? And God knows, we had to, you know, beg and scream for years. Why does this even have to be an ordeal? Like, if the people want it to happen, then it needs to just happen, right? Not, like, wait for some, you know, glorious overlord to make what we're looking for actually take place. But furthermore, I'm upset with the, you know, the centralized aspect of it, but I'm also really upset with just that it's not big enough. Like, it's not enough. Like, I guess a lot of people are sort of making excuses that, you know, this is a holdover, this is a temporary thing to get us into the future, but honestly, like, we just need to build a system where it's impossible, where it is impossible for a third party to manipulate traffic en route, right? We need to make it, furthermore, by extension, that will make it impossible for third parties to intercept and surveil information and traffic. Like, it'll make the NSA impossible, which of course they're not going to want, right? It'll make, you know, these ISPs will have to route traffic, and maybe there won't even be ISPs at all. I think that the bigger step that we actually need is a technological solution to replace a vulnerable internet architecture. The internet just is unacceptably centralized today, and this is what happens, right?
I think as far as that's concerned, I think the NSA is more impotent than you think, just because of the amount of data that they have access to and the inability to search relevant data in that. I also think that the answer to part two of that is some sort of a mesh net, but what we need a hardware manufacturer that can make that easy enough for everyone to use. And I know Jack had a comment here on this too.
I actually was going to say the same thing.
Meshnets, yes. Meshnets are what I think will answer this. But what you need with meshnets is you need hardware manufacturing, which creates another entire, you know, bag of worms that you need to open.
I disagree. I think hardware manufacturers are a second step to actual successful meshnets. I think to create a successful meshnet, all you need to do is create the incentive for parties to move into the space. And if you can reward them for participating, just like Bitcoin did with mining hardware did not exist as a solution until Bitcoin became sufficiently valuable. People innovated in that space because there was an incentivized solution. And I think the same answer is going to apply to the actual fixed version of the internet, a true mesh net that doesn't rely on any centralized party.
I'll be the first to admit, I don't actually know a lot about the net neutrality debate. I don't really follow it. But it is what you're saying that the net neutrality would prevent the NSA from gathering data? That's not my understanding of how that works.
No, so a sufficient defense, something that would technologically enforce net neutrality, would also have the side effect of preventing mass surveillance at the network level. Because in order to enforce net neutrality at the sort of the network level, and make it means that you would have to make it impossible for nodes along the route between you, the source, and the destination of information, you have to make it impossible for them to introspect on the data they're transiting. The only thing that they should even be able to see, if anything at all, is the source and destination. All they should see is encrypted data. In a case where you have a network built like that, it makes it not impossible, but it's certainly much, much, much more difficult for an NSA to just simply read the packets right as they go over the wire.
I see. So you're saying that sort of like that would, if you couldn't introspect on the data at all, if ISPs couldn't do that at all, that would be like a structural protection against it.
Yeah,
whereas
exactly.
This is more like legalistic. It's just saying, well, you have the capability to, but don't.
Right, right. So that's the thing is, like, because the capability to see traffic exists today, the parties that are routing that traffic are choosing which parts of the traffic to prioritize over another, and that is the net neutrality debate. I think the answer is going to be a end-to-end encrypted meshnet. There is no decrypted traffic at any capacity, probably some sort of asymmetric encryption scheme where only the intended recipient can decrypt the traffic or the possession of the corresponding private key thereof, right?
I think the ultimate solution would be homomorphic encryption. We can do everything on encrypted data.
Yeah, no, totally.
I think we're going to shoot back over to James, who wanted to speak on something else that was actually equally as interesting as meshnets, although meshnets will be a topic that will be brought up over and over again here because it's something I think all of us decentralizers really appreciate and want to happen.
Well, I don't know if this is as interesting as meshnets. Meshnets are pretty darn interesting. But one of the things I really noticed with the net neutrality debate, as well as with a lot of other kind of large political issues concerning the tech industry, was sort of the prevalence of sort of tech celebrities giving their opinions on it. And if we consider ourselves tech celebrities, we are included in that number. I don't think we can yet, but I'm very interested in sort of the rise of technologists as celebrities and also the rise of celebrities as technologists. And one of the articles you share with me, Tony, with Eric, was something, a great article you found on TechCrunch called Beware the Pretty People. And it's sort of talking about this larger idea that technology and sort of the Silicon Valley startup archetype have become so important to us as a culture that now it's actually become very glorified. And though we may see some negative results as an after effect of this. What do you think about that? Do you think we'll start to see maybe less of a focus on the technology we need as a result of things like the social network, movie, and all this kind of glorification of innovation?
I think it's general. In general, people are more interesting than stories. So you're going to see the same folks that rise to fame. And right now, who is it? Steve Jobs is probably the peak of it. Everyone knows Steve Jobs. Everyone thinks he's this genius. I disagree. I think he was a smart guy, really smart businessman, but no genius. But then now there's Elon Musk. Now there's there's plenty more. He's just the first one that's jumping to my mind. And it's that cult of here's this great person who's doing great things when there's all kinds of great people who have done just as great things, but go unheralded, right? Anyone who is involved with EFF, I would consider them on a plane higher. But also it has to do with this idea of Silicon Valley being sexy, right? And this as a marketing guy, I always hear, like, how sexy is it, right? Does that have anything to do with how quality the product is? When Google came out, and I hate using Google as the example, but I will, no one thought this is sexy. You know what people thought? This is minimalist, and it works really well. And guess what? A good product will be easier to sell than a shit product. It's common sense business here. Okay, but not much has changed.
But you know, there's a difference between like a sexy product, which is important, and like sexy personal stories, which are sort of, you know, ancillary to actually having a good business. So it's like, you know, if the focus is on Steve Jobs the person, that's kind of besides the point. Or if it, like, you know, like there was a very interesting article that if you like to like that, you know, the tech is hip now. So it's attracting all these trend chasers. And I agree that that's bad. I think that's actually because it leads to a less sexy product. You know, because it's just like, you get dazzled by, you know, the pretty people or whoever. And, you know, it turns out, well, these people might not be as good engineers. Because you took in, they almost by definition aren't, because you took into account that, you know, I liked that they were pretty. I took that into consideration. So I ended up with a worse set of engineers and a worse product.
Yeah, and I think in that article, there is a great piece that's about Bitcoin and blockchain technology being truly disruptive. That term disruption is so misused by tech. I really wish everyone that thinks that whatever industry they're in or whatever their product they're making is disruptive would really look at, are they disruptive or are they reducing cost or are they just providing some superficial nonsense? And really take a look at what they're doing and what they're creating. I mean, this is something that I've felt for a while, so when I read that article, I felt the need to share it with everyone. And I'm really interested to get James and Eric, both of your comments on this, since you're kind of, you know, you're folks that have a different opinion, and that's why I value it.
So I'm of the opinion that this is just a natural sort of effect, right? Like, you know, when Google came around, we were like, it was still before the first internet bubble, right? It was just at the very beginning of it, and they rose with the first internet bubble. They were one of the survivors of it. Tech was still very, like, anti-sexy back then. There wasn't, you know, the whole Silicon Valley sort of digital bubble, right? Everything was based on hardware, and this new internet thing was just not even a decade old at this point, right? The internet really only came onto the scene in, you know, 1993, 94. It was just sort of this questionable thing. You know, there's that notorious clip of the reporters is sort of saying, what is this internet thing? What is that little symbol, you know, you put in your name with like a little curly A, and they don't even know anything about it. And it strikes me that things have grown to the scale where now that it's baked into our lives, there's a lot of attention, and I view that as a good thing, because that means that there are different perspectives, and there is now a much greater consumer base for products to hit, right? There's a ton of different niches that anybody can build an application for. It is really important to sort of look at, I think there's like an adoption curve where you have like the initial bump of, you know, the early adopters, and then you have this chasm of, you know, impracticability and delusion and all of that. And then you have this long tail of growth. Now, the internet and tech, software tech at large, technology, I should just say, very broadly, is now in that long tail, and I think that this is an indicator of that. When you see the initial first bubble, like what you have with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and crypto finance in general, you're still on the upswing of that early adopter. It's going to be a while. It's going to be a long time until we hit that long tail, right? This is the next wave. These patterns repeat frequently as new and, frankly, disruptive technology. I'm going to use that word because, you know, in order to sort of impact anything, you have to do a 10x improvement to really provide disruption. And I think that's what Bitcoin and blockchain-based technology kind of does. These patterns will continue. They will totally continue. We just have to recognize and accept. We don't have like this, you know, our own little sandbox that we can keep, you know, the jocks and the pretty people out of anymore. Like, this is now everyone's sandbox, and that's a good thing. Everyone can play in this space now. Now we move on to innovating on the next layer on building a truly decentralized society.
I definitely agree with Eric. I think there's a lot of merit to that, and a lot to be encouraged about with this, even with all the issues. You definitely want to avoid sort of that sort of the hipster attitude of it was cool before everyone else found out about it. I don't think we're going to see that in the people who really care about what they're building. For me, I mean, I'm obviously not a programmer by nature, maybe one day, but this fact that decentralization technologies and disruption have become a part of a, sort of a larger cultural conversation It's allowing far more people to engage with technology and to understand it and to really see how they can improve their lives and actually give themselves more freedom and control over their lives. It's an absolutely, absolutely good thing. Definitely one of the drawbacks you might see is that as with any product, as adoption increases, the relationship of maybe the later adopters is going to be somewhat shallower than that of the relationship of the early adopters to technology. So really something, you know, we're doing as podcasters and what a lot of people are doing out there, like to people like publications like TechCrunch, is they are sort of adding that extra layer of understanding and concern with what technology is all about, you know, how we can actually make it free, make it useful for us. That's something that's definitely important to do. But I'm overall concerned, overall encouraged by this, apart from, you know, obviously some outlier cases in which sort of this new sheen of popularity can create some troubles.
I think the TechCrunch article was interesting because it was written from the perspective of, like, you know, the sort of the stereotypical, like, you're a nerdy outsider, and how this had kind of been, you know, their domain, and now it's being taken over by, you know, what they call the pretty people. So it's almost like, it's just like this undercurrent of resentment. But I think, like, the practical effects of it are, you know, it only is negative to the extent that it, like, impacts, say, engineering in a bad way, which, you know, I don't think that would always be true.
And I also think it's like when a really cool band that you love gets, you know, gets on the radio, you're like, oh, it's my band. This is my thing. And, you know, that's very natural. And, you know, with that being said, like the foundation of Bitcoin really is blockchain, right? And there are a lot of dangers to do with blockchain. And there was a lot of interesting conversations we've had over the past week. And I wanted to throw it to James, who had some information on this and a little bit to say on the dangers of blockchain, as well as identity and anonymity and a lot of other things related to this topic.
Sure. So obviously, like we're talking about with text adoption, we're seeing a similar kind of parabolic adoption in Bitcoin. Not parabolic, somewhat exponential adoption in Bitcoin, or at least interest in what Bitcoin can be used for. And obviously one of those is blockchain applications. In a lot of ways, I know Augur's working on this, in a lot of ways BitPay is working on this, Ethereum, whoever you want. This is definitely kind of the hot new space to be working in. And it's applications beyond money, essentially. So looking at sort of the ledger that Bitcoin uses as a monetary system to be used for things like identity management or government services, that sort of thing. We're seeing a lot of startups. One of the ones I encountered several months ago, which had some controversy around it, was BitNation. But obviously, projects like Ethereum also have aspirations of sort of providing a lot of the really essential services we use to interact online and actually in the real world. I know that IBM is currently working on a blockchain-based Internet of Things. They are using the blockchain really primarily as a way of actually allowing communication between devices, but there definitely have been theories on using smart contracts within Internet of Things connected devices like cars, basically using something like Ethereum to regulate the use of that. And what I'm really concerned about from a decentralized perspective is not the technology per se. I think it's really awesome. I think blockchain technology is pretty cool, or else I wouldn't be here. But what I'm really concerned about is the use of technologies like this in a world where centralization is a primary political value and cultural value in a lot of respects. I'm wondering how things like smart contracts will be used and enforced in an environment where governments are still kind of the main form of political organization. One of the for basically a use case of this problem, I think, and one of the ones which is most immediately on the horizon, is the use of identity systems. Identity systems tied to public keys registered on a blockchain, which are unforgeable as a result. And obviously, I think I had to go on for too long of a tangent here, but really, unforgeable identity systems, at least in the present world, are not a desirable good, but it is something that blockchains can give us. So I think we have to be very careful about creating this power and sort of thinking about how we're using it. So identity systems unforgeable in a world where passports and driver's licenses are kind of the main ways in which we interact with nations and governments. It's frightening to me, and I think it definitely needs to be reevaluated. But I wonder what your experience sort of is with a lot of these Bitcoin 2.0 applications and your thoughts on sort of whether they're advisable as things currently stand.
Yeah, so I'm of the opinion that the blockchain and the vision of the blockchain is flat out incompatible with the existence of a centralized state. A centralized state has incentives to use any type of technology as a mechanism for what they, in hopefully they want to perceive as a net good for the people. But anytime you apply something like that, like identity tracking, anytime you start aggregating information, anytime you start aggregating anything into a single rolled up place, it becomes a point of attack, right? It becomes a point of vulnerability, a single point of failure even, such that the need for a blockchain to be decentralized, it has to be decentralized, right? You can have, you know, specialized providers within the space, such as in the case of miners, such in the case of, you know, companies providing services, individuals providing services, but it's simply not compatible with the role of a centralized government to want to aggregate and roll up all of that information and the ability to track people. So I do think that this is going to be, this is the one opportunity I think we have to actually sort of transcend the sort of evolutionary gap in an intelligent civilization, where, you know, Earth has hit this point a number of times where a great empire has amassed a majority of the world's attention or wealth. You know, it goes all the way back to China, it goes up to Egypt, the Roman Empire, you know, the British Empire, and now the American Empire. And all empires fall, right? Each time you have this opportunity to radically change the way we think about things. At every point along this way, you know, we've had a different style of centralized government, and every single time the system sort of crawls to a halt and ultimately collapses under its own centralized weight. I think this might be the time. Now that all of those previous, you know, cycles, what they didn't have was instantaneous communication globally and coordination between the people. I think there is going to be a massive point of friction, right, where the existing power structure, the existing centralized authorities, whether it be governments or whether it be, you know, corporations, are going to try to use these tools, just like they did with the Manhattan Project initially, for things that are bad, are negative, right? Tracking people, enforcing violence upon people in any capacity, right? Whether that be through taxes or, you know, enforcement of laws that people didn't particularly elect themselves into. So it's a double-edged sword, but this is the case where we have to fight really hard towards the decentralized side to make sure that society as a whole emerges without this vulnerability that is a centralized state, right? It is a vulnerability, and we will never achieve the next level for the next 50 years, 100 years, 500 years, right, until we can break out of this, in my opinion, this dark cycle of centralization.
I also think it's important that we need to disambiguate voluntarism, anonymity, and identity. And I think that's something where identity is important. Identity and reputation systems are very important. And that's really what helps a voluntary, decentralized system work, right? And there's actually projects right now that are working on this. Identify.org, and that's identify with an I instead of a Y, is something. Now, albeit there's no proof yet that it's going to work, but it is a project where they're trying to tie in a basically having a decentralized address book in addition to having an identity you can use across the net, right? So if your Twitter gets hacked and, you know, you don't know who uses it, you can basically verify that, hey, that Twitter was hacked, here's my key, here's what it is, go on and so on and so forth. And I think that's something, that's the next, you know, that's the next nut that needs to be cracked here since Bitcoin has. It wouldn't shock me if that our Satoshi, if this is what they're working on next and trying to get credibility to identity. It's really a very difficult thing to comprehend, but it's something that can very easily be done.
I think one thing that's really tricky is that centralized technology is almost always more efficient. You know, it's almost always more efficient to just aggregate information in a centralized database, for example, put it on a website. than it is to use decentralized blockchain-based things. So I think, you know, where you'll see it make inroads are in situations where the centralized version is really intolerable for some reason, possibly due to state or corporate interference or whatever.
What I'm concerned about primarily, and really the reason I brought up this topic, is that centralized agencies are easier to fool. It's really hard to fool something like the blockchain. So, for instance, if something like Identify takes off, something like the blockchain ID, there are a number of projects working on this. Something like that takes off and is something which can be used by governments, or at least can be viewed on a public ledger by governments, which is, you know, the kind of the point of the blockchain. That can be a serious vulnerability. I definitely see the importance of identity, like you were saying, Tony. Like, there are definitely instances in which you want to have your reputation, you want to be able to leverage that. But I do think one of the most important things, insofar as we have states which, you know, impose on people's lives and liberties, is the ability to be anonymous. Really moving to a place where a universal identity enforcement is both possible and efficient through something like the blockchain or a decentralized unforgeable ledger like the blockchain. I think that's a serious vulnerability. But yeah, I think Eric had a note on this before we close out.
Yeah, so what's really interesting to me is, you know, you talk about identify.org, identify with an I. There's also bitrated.com, which has recently launched. What's really cool about this, and the fact that we now have, there's also, OneName is really doing some really interesting stuff. Keybase.io is doing some interesting stuff. All of these are competing in the same space. This, immediately, if you step back for a second and you look at, you know, the number of people out there building something on a decentralized tech versus, like, the centralized identity provider that is the government, you're absolutely going to come into, you're going to look at the one where there's competition, and it's going to end up with a better solution anyways. So check out all these solutions, bitrated.com, identify.org, onename.org, and keybase.io. These are amazing alternatives to sort of defend against some of the dangers that blockchain technology can provide in a centralized environment. So definitely check out the various options on the market.
Absolutely, and always exercise self-defense when you're interacting with these technologies. That's what decentralization is all about, is sort of understanding what you're using, having control over it, and I think we've really covered that quite well today. And we look forward to our interview with Paul Pooley in the next segment.
Hey everyone, today we're joined by Paul Pooley, who is the co-founder and CEO of Airbits. Thank you very much for joining us today, Paul.
Hey guys, pleasure being on the show. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So talk to us a little bit about Airbits. What inspired you to sort of get into Bitcoin and ultimately choose to start a Bitcoin wallet company?
Oh, let's see. How much time do you guys have? Entry into Bitcoin just came actually from me working both in technology about over a decade ago and then actually transitioning into small business. I'd worked and did everything from running a restaurant, bar, nightclub, and running a climbing gym and doing outdoor guiding, but still always being the technology guy at those companies and seeing the I was kind of that guy behind the counter getting screwed with chargebacks of credit cards and, you know, seeing the merchant consumer interface of technology being really, really poor and nascent. And then having learned about Bitcoin, instantly got fascinated. It took me about 2 weeks of research to realize that this was it. And from day one, I bought some Bitcoin and tried to use it. And as soon as I tried to use it, I saw, oh my gosh, this is even worse than the current infrastructure for consumer and merchant and people paying each other. And it didn't seem like it was a problem that could not be solved. And seeing the pain points and seeing what we could do based on the technology we had, I said this is a huge opening. And unlike the current ecosystem of payments that was really riddled with a ton of different companies trying to get into the space, this one was fairly young and nascent, and so it was a great opportunity to get into the space. And so really it's trying to ease the pain points of a Bitcoin user, you know, as a person who actually tried to use Bitcoin from day one.
Yeah, so would it be fair to say then that the Airbits wallet is differentiated by its user experience? How do you separate yourself from all the other wallets out there?
So there is an aspect of user experience that we have an incredible focus on. So we do take it from a very high level, like the user experience, the UI, fluidity, but at the same time we reveal that too many companies or implementations and projects compromise on core Bitcoin fundamentals of decentralization, privacy, autonomy in the mission to accomplish that user experience, where we've taken it and said, no way, we're not going to compromise on that. We want a decentralized wallet. We think that that's what made Bitcoin fundamentally successful to begin with, as opposed to all of the other digital currencies before it, and that's what will make wallets and other projects successful going forward within the Bitcoin space, is whether or not they can retain that decentralization, that fault tolerance, and scalability that was key to Bitcoin. So yes, you're right. We are focusing on user experience, but we're trying to deliver good user experience for a decentralized product, which I don't think anyone has really had that focus on before.
So Paul, what kind of growth have you seen in response to Airbits as a wallet? And do you see any challenges sort of with consumers kind of pitching the benefits of decentralization to them?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge that we run into is that people don't realize what we do under the covers. It's almost like our user experience hides a lot of our core values. And that was somewhat intentional, but also, you know, we're realizing that it's more of a challenge than we expected. So we want to deliver both. And I think we've actually delivered both, but people don't see that. So the people that are the true, like, not necessarily the crypto anarchists, but the uber privacy freaks, they see what we've built and it looks like a hosted wallet. And so they think that we're a hosted wallet, even though we give, in many aspects, privacy above and beyond the very kind of engineer-like wallets that are out there, the technical wallets that are out there. We almost surpass them in privacy in some respects. And so the challenge is the communication. Like, yes, here's something that grandma can use, but deliver the decentralized privacy that, you know, the other people care about. And so we've had to communicate that very carefully with people and say, actually, no, this is what happens in the wallet. No, actually, this is what happens in the wallet. And then once we get that communication out there, people start opening their eyes like, oh my God, really? You guys do that underneath the covers? And yes, you're open source, so if you are technical enough or are rich enough to hire someone to audit the code, then yes, you'll see that that is exactly what we're building.
One of my favorite features of Airbits is the ability to see what places near you accept Bitcoin. What basically spurred that to be a feature? Was this an idea where you were maybe looking for a place to spend Bitcoin and you were like, well, what places are nearby? So you use one of the maps and you realize this is inefficient, or was it just something that seemed easy to embed in the app? Basically, what was the genesis of that thinking?
Well, ironically, the genesis of that thinking was legacy mobile wallets. If any of you have ever used the PayPal wallet or the Square wallet or LevelUp or Mogul, they are mobile wallets, but being somewhat nascent mobile wallets, you need to know where you can use that wallet. So in the same sense, you know, we've built a merchant directory into the wallet so you know where you can use a Bitcoin wallet, and it's not tied, you know, specifically to any Airbits merchants because that doesn't really exist. I mean, you could use it lists every single merchant, you know, BitPay and any other merchant processor or people just using a wallet to take Bitcoin. So that was actually the inspiration behind it, in addition to me trying to use Bitcoin and realizing that it was really hard to find places. And this is a problem that's been solved. We've built directories in the past for every niche market, and there's no reason why we couldn't do it for Bitcoin in a good, seamless, easy-to-use manner. And luckily, two of my co-founders had came off a prior startup, and they had actually built a merchant directory as well, so they had the skill sets necessary to get that up to speed. And blending the two questions that were just asked of me, like, you know, what are the challenges you face? And, you know, why did you build this merchant directory? We built a merchant directory because it was, you know, for us, fairly simple and easy to do. But one of the challenges we face is that people think we're a merchant directory company, and they think that that is our core focus and not the wallet. And the wallet is a side project when it couldn't be any more opposite. We actually spend about 90% of our time on the wallet, and the technology that goes underneath the wallet is our core focus. The merchant directory is effectively a side project, and it's a feature of our wallet. You know, we want to give early adopters and evangelists the perfect tool to onboard people with Bitcoin. You know, in one app, you can send and receive Bitcoin that's easy to secure, that's familiar to secure, and at the same time, you could show someone that this is a real economy, there's a real currency that is usable in many, many different countries and different places.
No, I'm absolutely impressed by Airbits. Every time I update the app, I see there are significant improvements in every update, not just, you know, small UX changes, significant, you know, technological changes. Were there any projects you looked at when you got started to sort of inspire the sort of work you're doing and that you really modeled Airbits after, or modeled at least your values after?
Yeah, so we were, if you know anything about our data model, the data model of Airbits is, you know, trying to be decentralized but trying to be familiar. So we create private keys, private seeds on the device of the user. So the user has 100% control of their funds. We encrypt them on their device, and then we back up and synchronize them across their different devices. So many people might say, that sounds pretty familiar to the blockchain.info. And so to some degree, there was a little bit of inspiration from that, but that's about the end of the inspiration. After that, we've then actually gone and underneath the covers significantly overhauled how the data is synchronized, how the data is encrypted, how it's associated with users and whatnot, and how users access it. You know, we've built in the familiarity of a username and password. We've built in the ability to do password recovery, and we're soon launching two-factor that is so easy anybody could use it. It's, I'd love to talk about that if you guys have any interest in time, because I think this is going to be a game changer, because I think it's a critical security feature that many people disregard because it's kind of complex. I know I hate it, but I know how valuable it is. So a little bit of inspiration came from wallets like a blockchain, but at the same time, inspiration from other wallets that retain that level of decentralization where you access the Bitcoin network directly and you don't require, you know, a single entity.
So what you just said is really intriguing. So you're talking about two-factor auth. Two-factor auth is something that you know, a lot of security experts really recommend to everybody. Mm-hmm. The challenge being that it's actually kind of difficult to set up. A lot of times the preferred user experience is to send something over SMS or text messages, which is insecure, right?
Yep, so exactly.
What is the approach that you know you're taking, and what is this new feature that you're adding to the wallet?
So we're calling it one-touch two-factor, or one-touch two-factor authentication. Basically, we are only a mobile wallet. And I would say over 99% of people that actually utilize two-factor utilize it on a mobile device. So for the most part, the app is living in the same space as the two-factor authentication app. So we asked ourselves, well, why should it be two different apps? Why not just put them together into one single application? So I'm not bouncing from Airbits to Google Authenticator or Airbits to Authy or Airbits to my text messaging app and then copying and pasting six digits into my wallet. Just fold them together. So we've effectively done that, and we'll be launching that pretty soon, where you literally just go into settings and turn it on, and that's it. You never do anything else after that. And effectively, that generates the two-factor seed. For those of you that are technical and understand how two-factor works, for at least the Google Authenticator model, it creates the two-factor seed, shares it with the server, and from then on out, it actually does the hash with the time, that little 30-second window that you have, and sends that to the server to authenticate. And that thereby locks your account to the devices that have that two-factor seed. So if someone across the world happened to gain your login and password, they don't have that seed, they can't log into your account. And so we've enabled two-factor without you ever having to do anything to utilize it other than just turning it on. And I know I'm using this now on my device, and I'm like, this is great. I forget that I even have it on. It's just, it's so seamless that I'm blown away that no one's really done it before.
I have a quick question. This is actually my first introduction to Airbits. I'm curious, like, can you describe a little bit how this is decentralized? Like, I guess it's just a local mobile app. Is it like a light node, or how does that work?
So you're referring to just Airbits as a whole, not necessarily the two-factor aspect of it?
Yes.
Like how is it decentralized? Yeah. So we accomplished, I think, almost a tier of centralization versus decentralization. So the aspect of, I'll start from where it's most not decentralized and where we had to compromise. So where it's not decentralized is that there is a central server, standard SQL web app database that holds users' hashed logins and passwords, and that is how users authenticate and how they create an account. And so we can verify that that login hasn't been taken by some other user. So there's that one decentralized centralized database. And creating wallets, creating accounts goes through there. Now there's a peer-to-peer distributed storage, which actually utilizes Git. Most of you are fairly technical, so you know, Git is actually a peer-to-peer protocol. Many of us utilize it in a very client-server manner, like such as utilizing GitHub. But what million people don't realize is it's actually very, very peer-to-peer. There are no servers, there are no clients. So we host a handful of Git nodes, you know, in our own network. So we host all of the nodes, and it works similar to a blockchain in that someone pushes some encrypted data to these nodes, and the nodes push it into all the other nodes. So any of the nodes can be down, and your wallet can simply access a different node on the network. So that's a peer-to-peer, somewhat decentralized, except that we host the node, so it's partially decentralized. And then where it's most decentralized is the fact that the app can access the Bitcoin network without Airbits. So we utilize libBitcoin servers and also a few other, although centralized APIs, we don't rely on any one of them. So unlike wallets that, you know, even though you own the private keys, the wallet requires you to access the network through one company, through one API. We don't require that at all. And even if Airbits went down as a company and our servers went down, the wallet can still access the network. You can actually log in using a username and password on your phone, and it decrypts the data that's on your phone, and then you can send out your money. You can even log in airplane mode just to prove that you don't actually need our servers to log in. So our PIN login, which is convenient for people, that unfortunately does need a server, but you can always do a full username and password to log in without any servers at all. So it's a tier of decentralization. We think we've made a great compromise between, you know, what's most important with respect to decentralization and what's a little bit less important. You know, and there's a lot of functionality that can still work even if, you know, Airbits partially goes down or fully goes down. And I think we've made a good compromise.
I see. So that's interesting the way you're using Git. It sounds like the Git nodes are just set up by Airbits. Is that right?
Right now, they are just set up by Airbits. We're going to be open sourcing those server protocols, and really, it's literally just running a Git node and a light web app on top of it that helps communicate between the different nodes. And if you're familiar with Git, there's a thing called a commit hook. So it's a script or a program that can get triggered as soon as a node receives a commit. And we utilize that functionality of Git to push the data to other servers. So the nodes know the servers, they can actually push about releasing a lightweight app that people can run on their computer and be a node for themselves. So that way your phone can say, okay, well, there's a node that I know about. I'm at my house. I can push to this node, which is my own personal backup of my stuff, in addition to pushing to Airbits nodes. So it's something that we can do because our architecture can support it, which many other wallet architectures would be hard-pressed to be able to implement inside of their system.
That's interesting. So it's like, and how demanding, how computationally demanding is that? Like running a Git node, I imagine probably not very bad.
Not at all. It's barely a resource at all. And the nice thing is because it is peer-to-peer, you know, any number of them can go down. As long as we have one node up, you can still synchronize between your different devices. And really, that's not even that critical for your phone because your phone can still send and receive without the nodes. The only thing that gets synchronized is the metadata. The private keys have already been synchronized before you can even receive money. That's guaranteed. And then only the metadata on a regular basis gets synchronized between your devices. So it's not that demanding at all. The nice thing is Git is incredibly it's incredibly efficient. It knows when data has already been pushed to it, and so it doesn't actually push any additional data. So, and we can still make it much more efficient. Right now it's heavyweight with respect to it making connections and connect and deconnect. But we have plans for the future to make the connections a little bit more persistent, and you can, you know, subscribe to updates versus sitting there and polling. But right now it actually works pretty elegantly.
So one of the things you talked about where you first made some compromises is this sort of username and password store. That strikes me as something that it seems like you're architecting the entire Airbit stack in a way that once a good solution can be found, that it can be decentralized. Give me some of your thoughts on maybe like the future direction on how like a fully decentralized wallet or even Airbits in specific might work.
Actually, we thought about the idea of the wallet. One of the inspirations, I should rewind a little bit, was actually BitTorrent Sync. I don't know how many people are familiar with BitTorrent Sync, but you know, with one long random key, you can basically synchronize between arbitrary number of devices, even poke through NAT firewalls. And we'd originally thought of that and said to ourselves, well, you know, we can create a wallet on a phone, create this sync key, and anytime you put that sync key on another device, you basically synchronize the data. So that was our original idea. We realized that there were some headaches in being able to determine collisions between usernames and passwords, which was the ease of use that people almost demanded. And we had started to think of other alternatives. And one of the big alternatives that came across our plate was MadeSafe. And as soon as I heard MadeSafe launch, I actually flew to the Austin, Texas Bitcoin conference, and I was able to get 4 hours with David Irvin and Nick and chatted with them about the architecture. And I was very excited about it. It is basically username password focused, and it's decentralized storage. So it was a great fit, except that it just was too early. It wasn't necessary. It didn't look like it was going to be ready by the time we were ready to launch. And so we had to kind of devise something on our own, and hence this idea of Git. And the nice thing is because we didn't compromise and decided to just put it on a database, we feel like we can shoehorn in a different decentralized storage in its place should something come around in the future. So, you know, we're ready for it if it comes around, but in the meantime, we've got a solution that I think encompasses a high enough level of decentralization where, yes, you can't create a new account if our centralized server goes down. You can't create a new wallet, but you can still send and receive. And, you know, at least we can also peer-to-peer backup people's data so that it can synchronize between devices, and that becomes much more fault tolerant than if we just had a central server. So that still excites us, and we think we've gone, you know, 90%+ there. And, you know, we'll still try to get to that 100% as the technology evolves.
That's really exciting to hear. We're all really big fans of actual true decentralization, but we also recognize the market readiness in a lot of cases just isn't there, and the technologies haven't been tested. Right. One of the other areas of decentralization that is really interesting, and you and I have talked about this in the past, which is the identity problem, right? So payment protocol has the, you know, the X509 certificates kind of baked in, which has a very very deep level of centralization that sort of forced upon people to use payment protocol. Talk a little bit about Airbits's perspective on this and what you guys would like to see in the future.
Really, I think as soon as we find a good, well-adopted, or even not well-adopted, just like early adopted, where we can kind of drive its adoption, protocol that decentralizes identity management, whether it be on like a Namecoin, a sidechain, or even preferably baked into the Bitcoin protocol itself, that's something, and that replacing X509, then we'd be very excited about utilizing that onto payment protocol and any other tool that needs some aspect of identity management. And I'm hesitant to say the word identity management because for all of those, you know, identity privacy freaks out there, they start saying, oh my God, I don't want to give up my identity. Well, when I say identity, it's just simply, you know, even a handle that can identify this machine or this public address as being owned by, you know, this handle which is established, whether or not there's any person or company behind that handle. And so being able to make that attachment has an incredible amount of value, but whatever that system is that comes about, it would be nice if there wasn't a central authority behind it, such as the way we use DNS today. An aspect also of the protocol, which I'm hoping that we could resolve going forward, and it's one of those where this will depend on the way Bitcoin goes going forward, whether or not we end up using payment channels and being able to pay offline. But having traveled the world and you try to use Bitcoin as much as possible, I find that internet connectivity and the ability to use Bitcoin right now go very hand in hand, but they don't necessarily need to. I've chatted a lot with people on Reddit that were very excited about the ability to send a signed transaction over Bluetooth to a merchant, and that merchant being the one that broadcasts the transaction. And that can be doable today using kind of the standard QR codes and NFC. That becomes a bit more of a challenge as soon as payment protocol starts coming into play. Even if we did have decentralized identity management, we'd still be tied to being able to make this HTTP request over to a server and determining, you know, what is the actual address, is this person who they are. If we can solve that problem of identity management in a way that the sender doesn't absolutely need to have internet connectivity, then I think we have the potential to really broaden the adoptability of Bitcoin. Because just me, as someone with an actual, you know, smartphone, traveling to even developed countries like Australia and New Zealand, struggle to use Bitcoin on a regular basis, even when I had a merchant that was taking it because of this issue. So that's kind of my take right now, but I think some aspect of the payment protocol can be very widely adopted with a few tweaks.
So Paul, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your experience kind of as a startup. You were recently admitted to the Plug and Play Accelerator. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, how it's been helpful to your company, if it has, and what that's been like?
Oh man, it's been tremendously helpful, and we're excited to be at Plug and Play and working with Scott Robinson, who's the FinTech Bitcoin Accelerator Director over there. Ironically, we got in through the program, not through the Bitcoin or FinTech Accelerator. We had actually pitched at an event in San Diego, and Plug and Play has a presence in San Diego, you know, looking for startups to recruit into the program. We pitched over there, got accepted amidst, you know, almost 1,000 applicants, and came in through Startup Camp. And the experience has been a blend of both being at Plug and Play and getting introduced to a lot of the names and faces, being part of their meetup program, because they let us have a strong presence whenever they host their meetup, which, you know, used to be once a week, now it's about once a month. And then also just getting introduced into the Bay Area scene, which is really huge, you know, being able to be part of the events that occur here in San Francisco. I think our second day at Plug and Play, we met someone who had a startup and loved Bitcoin, although he wasn't a Bitcoin startup, and let us know about a meetup that was happening in like 20 minutes. He goes, hey, are you guys going to the PayPal meetup in 20 minutes? And I was like, oh, we just got here. We didn't know about it. And so he said, you should check it out. They're talking about Bitcoin. I'm like, sweet. So we packed our bags, headed over to this meetup, and through that we met the speaker, Lauren, at the meetup, and he was the one who was hosting the O'Reilly conference, which was here in San Francisco about a couple months ago. And, you know, we weren't sure if we were going to go. It was pretty expensive, and he gave our entire team, free passes to the event, since we're a startup and, still early on, expensive to afford those passes. He invited us over, and through that we met a ton of people, a lot of great potential partnerships, a handful of investors who to this day we're still in contact with. And if it wasn't for that nice serendipitous moment from us being at Plug and Play and meeting the right person to send us to the right event, to you know our team being able to go to this and meet other people, it would, you know, wouldn't have happened. So a big chain of events and things like that have been happening by being in the program and being here in the Bay Area that we're really grateful for. So it's been great. They've also given us great advice, and we've tweaked our message, our pitch, how we tell people what we are. Our focus has definitely been refined, what we are doing and what we're going to deliver. And we have a big demo day coming up in a couple of weeks where we're going to be launching, you know, two-factor and another feature as well. So no, it's been a great experience by far.
Another follow-up I might have to that is sort of asking about your experience as an entrepreneur. If you feel comfortable with sharing with us, what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes you've made as an entrepreneur or as a company, and how have you kind of come back from those?
Biggest mistakes are underestimating the, especially when you're an early company and people don't know exactly who you are or what you do, underestimating how hard it is to communicate your message if you do more than one thing. And that was our challenge because we had launched as a merchant directory and actually gained quite a bit of traction as a merchant directory, and people liked what we built, and it almost overshadowed our wallet, and this is what I mentioned earlier. And I completely disregarded, not disregarded, but underestimated how bad that miscommunication would be. And you know, we'd gone to a meetup in our hometown of San Diego, and William, one of my co-founders, had even asked a handful of people, he goes, "Hey, do you know what Erbitz does?" And he goes, "Yeah, you're a merchant directory." He goes, "Do you know we have a wallet?" And you know, out of every 10 people he asked, I think less than 50% knew that we were a wallet. And the people that knew that we were a wallet thought we were a wallet that only worked with our merchant directory. And for the people that thought that knew we were a general purpose wallet, didn't, they thought that it was a side project and that we didn't have a core focus on it. So that message and communicating what you do, even though you think you're doing a good job, is probably the thing that I definitely underestimated, and the need for that aspect of marketing, like the communications aspect of marketing, not marketing, putting ads, blah, 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 but really communicating your vision, what you do, how you're doing it, and why people should care has been the thing that I've definitely underestimated, that you know we are now really cranking on. Hence, we go to these events, and we talk, and we do the podcast, and we want to hear feedback from people, too. Like, what are the things that people think about when they first hear about our company and use our product? So incorporating that feedback has been really beneficial for us, but also one of the challenges that I think other entrepreneurs should be aware of is, what is your message? Make it simple, make it easy for people to understand, make it memorable.
Yeah, so you're talking about keeping a narrow focus when you're developing a business, and otherwise the message can get muddy. I think the larger conversation around Bitcoin is getting pretty confused, or has been pretty confused since the beginning, because there's so much disinformation and so many different aspects of it that it's very difficult to navigate as a newcomer to the space. What do you think are some of the solutions to reduce the complexity and make it easier for consumer adoption to actually happen?
Well, one thing, and I had actually, someone had asked me one of my predictions for 2015, and I put BitPay on the spot, and I said that from a viewpoint of consumer adoption and merchant adoption, that BitPay would make those incredibly strong partnerships with the point-of-sale companies, where we're not running these little mobile apps on our phone to take Bitcoin as a payment, but instead it just is integrated in these systems that we're already using. So I think that's going to help drive this recognition. It's like, oh, it's just another payment method that's everywhere. And then, of course, we ourselves are working on bridging consumer adoption by making a wallet that's familiar to set up and familiar to use. And so, you know, we're excited about NFC getting driven forward. So it's tap to pay like an Apple Pay. And there's nothing stopping Bitcoin from being as simple to use as Apple Pay, absolutely. And then the missing link from that is, how do you create and secure a wallet in a familiar way? And that's what we think we've solved in a pretty good way, is that, oh, username, password, that's all I need. I can access it from any number of devices. It's backed up, it's secured. That's, I think, from a consumer spending wallet, we've solved that. One of the challenges is now when people are actually sinking a good amount of money into Bitcoin, I haven't seen yet what I'd consider to be a mass adoptable solution for large fund storage. You know, people say, oh, man, that Trezor is easy. It's easy for us, for the early adopters and people that care enough. It's not one that I think the masses would use, and same with like Ledger Wallet. They're great. They're getting simpler and simpler, but for mass storage, I don't think we've solved that yet. And paper wallets, to me, are not a solution for the masses. So that is still, I think, one of the missing things, is how do we secure large storage in a decentralized way that a lot of consumers can handle? And we have an idea of how to do that using multisig and still be as familiar as opening a bank account. But you know, no one's done it yet, and it's still in our roadmap as opposed to being imminent to release.
So in regards to wallets in general, who do you consider your biggest competition to be? When you're saying, okay, we want market share of this specific, you know, of wallets in general, who are the leaders in the field and who are you really going after?
Well, the biggest challenge when we start talking about Airbits is people, number one, don't see the value, at least a good handful of people that we come across don't see the value, number one, in just a decentralized wallet, one where people own their private keys. So our first battle is just communicating that. And what is the value of owning your private keys? And there's people think that when I say that, that I'm an ideologist and that's it, and that I only care about that from an ideology point of view. And that is partially true, but I actually care about it from a usability point of view as well, because I think hosted wallets provide a very poor user experience when you actually try to spend funds. And I've hit this, and many of my friends have hit this, and all of our co-founders have hit this when trying to use a hosted wallet to send money. It can't reliably send money because of the aggregation of people's funds and so much of it being in cold storage. So the first challenge we have is, and the first level of competition is effectively the hosted wallets. Now, once people have decided, okay, well, I believe in being able to hold my keys, then the landscape is, well, I mean, blockchain.info is definitely in the public eye and public mind. They're the ones that, you know, come up when you do a search for a Bitcoin wallet. You see blockchain.info. So they're a huge name in the space, and you know, I give them a lot of respect for coming up with a good wallet at the time that they came up. And of course, there's other wallets. There's Mycelium, there's Bread Wallet, Green Address, and whatnot. And so a lot of those, I think, are still what I'd call the Bitcoin early adopter style wallet. They don't have the familiarity needed for the masses, but they at least uphold the values that we care about. And so I'd rather someone be using that than a hosted wallet.
So, Paul, what is your world domination plan? What is your sort of your 10-year or 20-year plan for Airbits? What do you see as sort of big in the future for you?
Got it. So long term, we definitely want to be one of the top three mobile wallets, and I think we're aiming to achieve that, obviously through that familiarity, ease of use. But long term, we want to incorporate functionality inside of the wallet that really tries to bring a lot into the mobile landscape. So we're actively talking, for example, with like buy-sell services around the world. One of the biggest pieces of feedback we get from people that onboard new users with our wallet is that, okay, well, I've set them up with your wallet, but then they ask the question, how do I buy Bitcoin? And then that starts to delve into, okay, now I've got to have two accounts, one to buy Bitcoin, and then I've got to go through the effort to transfer it into the wallet. So we said, you know, there's no reason why we can't incorporate APIs from services that offer buy-sell right into the wallet without it being Airbits holding the money. And so we're already incorporating one from a new startup coming out that allow buy-sell through our wallet, linking a bank account through ACH, and in a few clicks, it automatically transfers the Bitcoin into your wallet. So it's, in a way, an exchange service or a buy-sell service without you having to trust a third party with your keys and fully integrated. And we're excited to be able to launch that functionality, you know, in a little bit. So things like that. And the nice thing about that is we can onboard these buy-sell services in many countries in short order versus trying to be a company that offers the hosted wallet buy-sell service in one country and then dealing with all the regulatory landscape of another and then dealing with all the regulatory landscape of another and then another and another, slowly and slogging through it all. Whereas there are people that are local, they're native, they're in those countries, they're dealing with it, and they know the system. And instead of working with those partnerships and having this global partnership reach and folding that into our app so that you can just simply say, hey, you need Bitcoin, install this wallet, and you can buy Bitcoin using that same device. And now we also build, as opposed to a single remittance rail, you know, a lot of people are talking about using Bitcoin to do remittance, and they tend to focus on a specific rail. Oh, we're a remittance for, you know, Thailand, for the Philippines, for Mexico. Instead, it's, hey, well, if you're in a developed country, install Airbits and buy your Bitcoin, and then tell your friend in the developing country to install Airbits, and they can sell their Bitcoin. And it doesn't matter where you go to and where you come from. It's not a rail. It's a network. It's a web of internet connectivity. And that still allows a lot of our partners to benefit. So we're not trying to keep everything in this closed ecosystem where Bitcoin isn't actually being transferred. It's simply, you know, staying inside of our ledger. This is, you know, utilizing the blockchain utilizing decentralization and different partners around the world. So that's what we have as one of our kind of global long-term visions to connect the world with Bitcoin.
Paul, all right, one last question. And our listeners, they all have their own unique answer to this. But what, in your eyes, why is decentralization important?
It depends on what industry we're talking about. For the sake of Bitcoin and the sake of currencies, it's important for the sake of fault tolerance, anti-fragility. And those, we know that we're in an industry that many people will not want to succeed. It's going to be fought. It's going to be a bit of a slugfest and a battle. And it was with prior currencies, and it's going to be with implementations of this currency. So if we want it to succeed and we want it to be able to survive that battle, I think we need to keep it decentralized, because decentralization is the one thing that offers that level of fault tolerance that can really weather those storms that will be coming up. And I'm absolutely confident that that's going to come down the pipe. So if you care about this technology surviving, then it needs to, as much as we possibly can, make it fault tolerant through decentralization, and that's the single most important thing that I can think of. There's a handful of others in that respect, but that's probably the most important in my mind. There's aspects of privacy which are hard to accomplish without decentralization, and the challenge now is, how do we make decentralization familiar and easy for everyone else, because our world hasn't really cared about it for a long time, because we haven't developed a technology that's going to be as disruptive and fought as this one. Like, the internet's somewhat decentralized data, but it wasn't, it didn't have the behemoths that would not want it to succeed the way Bitcoin has the behemoths that will not want it to succeed. So in a long-winded answer, hopefully that answers it in a way that the listeners can resonate with.
That was a splendid answer, Paul. Can you tell our listeners where they can find out about Airbits and follow you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Paulinator with two L's, P-A-U-L-L-I-N-A-T-O-R, and then Airbits with a Z, A-R-B-I-T-Z.co, and then on Twitter at Airbits as well. We've got a Google Plus page. You just search it. It comes up all over the interwebs, so it shouldn't be too hard to find us. You can also find us at a handful of events. I'll be speaking at the Texas Bitcoin Conference later this month, as well as the New York Inside Bitcoins Conference in April. And if we have any other events coming up, I'll be sure to put those on social media and on our webpage. So definitely reach out, ask us questions, and most importantly, give us feedback. We really want to make sure we're building the product that the community wants. We are very excited about the potential of Bitcoin and Airbits, and so we have a list, like, let's see if my hands can fit in the screen, this big, that we want to put into our product, or at least improve and add functionality, but at the same time, we only have time for like this much, so we want to hear what people want out of it, so we can kind of funnel our efforts into what the community wants.
Well, decentralized listeners, if we believed in marching orders, you would now have them. But thank you so much for joining us, Paul. We really enjoyed the interview, and we love what you're building.
Cool.
So we look forward to seeing where Airbits goes over the next few years.
Awesome. Cool. We look forward to it, too. Look forward to hearing what happens with decentralized and keeping this show as decentralized as possible. It'd be awesome to hear.
We'll be doing it. Thanks.
Cool. Take care.